Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Lord Lamont, for a brilliant introduction to this discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll take you back to May 1991 and to a comment that none of you have forgotten, I'm sure. It came from a certain Mr. Paul Keating, who introduced this vexed nation to the notion of a recession that you had to have, or we had to have. But while all of you remember that, I'm sure that most of you are not familiar with another similar statement at precisely the same time. Thousands of kilometers away, some other gentleman had said, and I quote, "Rising unemployment and the recession have been the price that we have had to pay to get inflation down. That price is well worth paying." The gentleman in question was Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time, a certain Mr. Norman Lamont, whose presence we are fortunate to be experiencing here today. Both treasurers suffered significant political damage as a result of those statements. But whether one agrees with those, with their policies or not, they did have a point. Periods of growth powered by an unsustainable credit, riding a bubble in real estate and financial markets, give rise almost automatically to the corrective medicine of recession. Sequential bankruptcies are to capitalism that which hell is to Christianity. Intensely unpleasant, but absolutely essential. There is indeed something redemptive about recessions and crises. They weed out companies whose fundamentals do not warrant their continued survival. They correct wayward asset prices, especially in the real estate market. They restore profitability to the better and more efficient companies. They arrest humanity's tendency to think that this time it's different and that the laws of sustainable accumulation no longer apply. Political economists of both the left and the right have always known this, have always known that which Mr. Keating and Mr. Lamont dared imply. Karl Marx, Joseph Schumpeter, Friedrich von Hayek are names that come to mind. Nevertheless, ladies and gentlemen, when you cast your wary gaze upon our European continent, make no mistake. There is nothing redemptive about the crisis in Euroland. Instead, what we have is a crisis that we did not have to have, one that produces no benefits, that comes with no silver linings, save perhaps the morbid satisfaction that some of us who had prognosticated that nothing good will come out of the Eurozone may feel presently. But it is, believe me, a rather shallow satisfaction. Small pickings in the context of the greater scheme of things. We, in the periphery of the Eurozone, live in wastelands these days. And perhaps more ominously, in the context of the state of the global economy, the Eurozone's disintegration harbors for peoples both within and without the Eurozone grave dangers. People who I'm sure include our friends in Britain, but also Australians. After all, no economy is an island. Initially, there was going to be a representative of the European Central Banking System in our midst, Santro, who would have given a good balance in these proceedings. And I'm saying this because I shall not disagree with the gist of anything that Lord Lamont said regarding the Eurozone. I hope that Justin offers the balance that would be missing without him, by presenting a more Euro-loyalist perspective than either mine or Lord Lamont's will be. Like Lord Lamont, I too think that we Europeans created a monster in the Eurozone. And just like Mary Shelley's Dr. Frankenstein, whose intentions were not all bad, we now find ourselves unable to control the creature, our own creation, a vicious beast that is wrecking our neighborhood with reckless abandon. To cut a long story short, what we decided in Europe to do by binding monetarily our 17 economies, but not in any other meaningful way without fiscal union, without political union, effectively we did two things at once. Firstly, we remove the shock absorbers of flexible exchange rates. And secondly, we ensure that the next shock, when it happens, when it hits, would be massively larger than it would have been without the Eurozone. There is no doubt in my mind that the euro was a gross error. In this, I side entirely with Lord Lamont. We should never have allowed the separate agendas of the different European elites to converge upon this monstrosity. However, thankfully for the interest of a lively debate in this setting, I shall disagree with Lord Lamont regarding what needs to be done now. Lord Lamont believes that the Eurozone should be dismantled in an organized fashion. It was a bad idea, and here I agree with him, so let's wind it down carefully yet purposely. Alas, I do not believe this is possible. No heavily financialized, highly leveraged currency union has ever been dismantled orderly in the past. The disintegration of the Latin Union in the 19th century or of the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia in the 1990s were cases of disintegrating currency unions, but they have no bearing on the importance of the Eurozone for the world economy and the nature of the beast. Consider for a moment how this unwinding could happen. Suppose that it is the weakest link in the chain that goes first. So my Prime Minister, Mr. Samaras, in Athens, convenes Parliament next Friday afternoon, passes an emergency bill through Parliament that reintroduces the drachma, declares that on Monday the banks will remain shut for a week while they are recalibrating their systems, and stamping, using indelible ink, some kind of stamp on the euro notes in the system to separate them from euros and to declare that these are no longer euros but they are drachmas. What do you think will happen next? Well, let me tell you. Within 10 minutes of the news coming out of Parliament, the ATMs in Athens, but very soon in Dublin and in Lisbon, will have dried out as depositors, either knowing or fearing mass devaluation of their deposits, will withdraw as much cash as they can. Very soon after that, Athens, Dublin, and Lisbon will have to reintroduce border controls impeding capital and human movements in order to prevent the hemorrhaging of their economies. Instantly, they will have violated the most cherished principles and laws of the European Union. And when the financial markets open on Monday morning, intense panic will grip investors and Spanish-Italian bonds will be unloaded in a fire sale that is going to resemble Margin Call, the movie. I don't know whether you've seen it. At that point, Mrs. Merkel will be presented with a hideous dilemma. Either put up more than 50% of Germany's GDP as a backstop for the remaining Eurozone, or get out herself with a press conference declaring the reconstitution of the Deutschmark, something that would please Mr. Jens Weidmann, the chairman of the Bundesbank, no end. He's already waging a campaign for the return of Germany to the Deutschmark. The Netherlands, Finland, and Austria will immediately enter into negotiations with Berlin, hoping that they will come under the new Deutschmark umbrella. France will be knocking on Berlin's doors, asking for the same, and receiving a big fat nine. Within a week or two, there will be a new currency union under the Deutschmark, it may be called something else, east of the Rhine and north of the Alps. What will happen to the rest of the European Union, I shudder to think. But the new Deutschmark Lebensraum is going to experience a massive inflight of capital as capital flees from the rest of Europe and the rest of the world into the German area in search of higher returns following the revaluation of the new currency. Immediately, the exchange rate of the new Deutschmark will shoot up and the Chinese market will be lost to that German area. Deflation and higher unemployment, double, triple what it is now, east of the Rhine and north of the Alps, is going to signal a catastrophic collapse in world demand, while the rest of what is now the Eurozone, whether they go back to their individual currencies or stay with the euro or form some other kind of Latin Union, is going to be gripped in an awful stagflation. The United States and the United Kingdom, which are teetering on the verge of a second dip, of a double dip recession, are going to fall deeper in it. And Asia and Africa, the BRICS, who are already preparing for an emergency landing, soft or hard, I'm not sure, are going to see their dreams of growth and development take a back, go to the backstage. Even if the Eurozone's dismantling were to be more orderly, and that could be achieved if Germany decided to leave first, not Greece. Again, we would have a deflationary surplus nation part in Europe, east of the Rhine and north of the Alps, and a stagflationary rest of the Eurozone. So my message to my Eurosceptic friends of both the left and the right is beware what you're wishing for the cruelest God is the one who grants us our greatest wishes. We may wish that inane Euro-loyalists get their comeuppance, that they learn their lesson the hard way. But tragically, the pain will spread far and wide, and the vast majority of victims will be outside the Eurozone and will suffer far more than the Eurocrats ever will. If I'm right that we should aim to fix the Euro rather than dismantle it, how should we do it? One thing is for sure, certainly not by means of our current policy mix. We must end bailouts that are being funded by CDO-like bonds that contain within them the domino dynamic that causes more European banks and states to fail sequentially. We must drop asking the German taxpayer to guarantee the periphery's debts on conditions of Ponzi austerity that reduce our country's capacity to repay their debts. We must end the denial that this is a systemic euro crisis. And lastly, we must stop pointing moralizing fingers at each other. Secondly, a second certainty is that federation is not the solution to this crisis. All our federal moves will be outpaced by this ongoing crisis. And anyway, as Lord Lamont said, the European peoples now are in a state where the last thing they want to countenance is closer unity. So where does this leave us? How do we fix the monstrous euro for the sake of the whole planet? The answer is simple. By redeploying our existing institutions, the European Central Bank, the European Investment Bank, and the European Stability Mechanism that we just created, in a manner that ends this crisis without asking the German taxpayers to guarantee a single euro of peripheral debt, without printing money, and certainly without asking European peoples to give up more of their sovereignty. Technically, it is more than possible, and we can discuss this perhaps later, how this could happen. The problem lies in the realm of politics. In her final parliamentary speech, Mrs. Thatcher said, and I quote, "It's all politics. Who controls interest rates is political. A single currency is about the politics of Europe." Well, you know that the crisis is very deep when a left-wing Greek economist is quoting from Mrs. Thatcher. Where Mrs. Thatcher was wrong was that behind the Eurozone agenda, there was an agenda for federation. Proof that there isn't such an agenda is the current banking union debacle. Everybody knows a banking union is a prerequisite for stopping Italy and Spain from falling into aggression vortex. And yet Germany is single-mindedly working to wreck, in practice, the banking union which it pays lip service to. A typical case of confirming one's pledges in the breach rather than in the observance. In conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, the worst enemies of European unity today are those who profess to serve and to believe in it, not the Eurosceptics. Indeed, those of us who despise the euro have the highest moral responsibility, obligation, to help fix it. Technically, we can achieve this in weeks, in a manner that we may discuss. But as Mrs. Thatcher might have said after consulting Bill Clinton, it's the politics, stupid. And as we have found, after 3 years and 20 summits in Europe, there is no shortage of organized stupidity on the European stage today. Thank you so much.